You're listening to the Bottom Line podcast, where those living with or beyond bowel cancer, as well as health professionals involved in bowel cancer treatment and care, share their inspirational stories and lived experiences with host and bowel cancer survivor, Stephanie.
Genetics and our familial history is now an important component of a cancer patient's journey. Alicia Harper is a genetic counsellor with the Alfred Clinical Genetics Service. She's been working for over a decade across numerous diseases, but today we're talking genetics specifically around cancer and bowel cancer and the implications for these patients and their loved ones. Thanks so much for joining me today, Alicia, on the Bottom Line podcast. It's great to finally meet you in person.
Thank you for having me.
I've known of you for a while through my sister, who is also a genetic counsellor, so it's lovely to meet, although by Zoom, but face-to-face.
Yes. Yeah, we're in the same city, but we're just near each other. Yeah.
Exactly. I've watched from afar what a genetic counsellor does, although I'm still not totally familiar. So today will be a great podcast for me as well. But I've watched with utter amazement, and I've also watched over the years with my sister the change. It's such a dynamic area, isn't it, in the world of cancer?
Absolutely. The genetic information that we're gathering and our understanding of the genetics of cancer is changing exponentially. So I think back on when I first started as a genetic counsellor, what we could offer families compared to what we can offer now, and it's really different and it's exciting, really.
So I suppose for the patient, it is such a big mystery. So today I'd like to unpack some of that. Could you just briefly describe what you do in layperson's terms as a genetic counsellor?
I think that's really common that a lot of people don't know what a genetic counsellor is and what we do. I think some people think they come to us and think, oh, we're coming to get counselled, like they're coming to see a psychotherapist, and that's not the case. So our main role is really we're a healthcare provider. We provide a service to individuals and families who are impacted by a genetic condition in their family. So our role is to provide information and education about a condition, but as well as providing support and advocacy for the family as well. So some of the information that we might discuss with a patient or a family is what a condition is and what it looks like and how it might progress, what family life might look like or how it might change because of a condition, how likely it is that family members also get this condition, so who's at risk and what that might look like, how people can manage the condition, and also point people in the right direction of accessing supports and services that are available to help families and individuals really adapt to a condition and manage it going forward.
What then is the difference between a genetic counsellor and a geneticist?
Yeah, great question. Look, I think that the thing to remember is we work as a team and we all have different skills that come together, which is really helpful. But ultimately, a clinical geneticist is a doctor. So they're someone who has trained as a doctor and been through, you know, the internship, residency, fellowships, and then they've completed a specialized training in genetics. So they are able to diagnose conditions. So you might come see a geneticist if you're trying to work out if you have a condition, and they're able to help you diagnose that condition. Whereas genetic counsellors, they have specialist training too, but it's a master's degree. And most of us have come from a background of something like science or nursing or some sort of social skills, so social work. And we have training in genetics and counselling skills. So we're health professionals that obtain that training to help educate and really counsel families and manage that kind of mental health support. Now, our skills overlap. So obviously, geneticists can provide counselling as well and provide mental health support. And we can help educate people on medical information. But it's those kind of slight differences around who can provide a diagnosis and then who's probably more skilled at providing that mental health support to be able to sit with the counselling side of things.
I think the way you've described it, that as a team, and more as I do these podcasts, that becomes very evident that, you know, when, especially when you're a cancer patient, you have a full team, but you're working as a team in the genetic space.
Absolutely. We don't work in isolation. And I think that's really important for people to know is that if you call a genetic counsellor, you're also really calling geneticists as well. Or if you call a geneticist, they'll often share that information with the genetic counsellor. We're a team.
When do you then see a genetic counsellor? At what point in the pathway, or what's the referral pathway? And I suppose that's a very broad question because it depends on a variety of areas. So I suppose let's first go down the line that you've been diagnosed with bowel cancer in the first instance.
Absolutely. So let's, as you say, let's focus on bowel cancer because I think every cancer condition has a different point where they might be referred to genetics. But you may be referred to genetics if you've been diagnosed with bowel cancer at a variety of different stages. So one would be if you're diagnosed young. So for example, if you're under the age of 40, you would qualify for a genetic test automatically because of your age. And so it would be important to be referred to a genetics team then because cancer impacts one in two of us now by the time we reach our mid-80s. But to see cancer at a young age makes us a little bit more suspicious that there's something that's predisposed you to develop that cancer. If you've been diagnosed with a bowel cancer and you've got a family history, that might ring some alarm bells as well for the referring team. So they may refer off to say, well, actually, was this person predisposed to develop this bowel cancer? The other thing that may flag a genetics review is that when you've had a bowel cancer removed, for example, you have a bit of your cancer tissue sent off to the lab. And they can do some specific testing that may flag that someone's got a genetic condition. And so sometimes that result makes the doctors think, well, maybe we should investigate this further.
We are talking bowel cancer. So there is specific genetic tests that you can do around BRAF, Lynch. Is Lynch syndrome one now? I know when I was diagnosed, 12, 13 years ago, gosh, that's flown. It wasn't a matter of course. I had to ask for it because my mother had died of ovarian cancer and I had a sister who was a genetic counsellor.
Yeah.
But is that now a matter of course? Should you be referred for Lynch syndrome testing?
So the first step is really having those tests on the tumour first. So my understanding is that the national recommendation is that anyone diagnosed with a bowel cancer or an endometrial cancer, which are the two more common Lynch syndrome cancers, should have their cancer tumour tested for what's called the mismatch repair genes. And basically, that looks at the tumour to see if the proteins are present. So if the proteins aren't present in the tumour, that may give us a little bit of a hint that there's an underlying genetic condition. Sometimes that happens just in the cancer, and sometimes it's happened because someone's been born with a genetic condition. And so anyone under the age of 50 should be having that done. And it's something that you could ask your oncologist or your surgeon if that's being done on your tumour at the time of diagnosis.
We talk on this podcast and a lot at Bowel Cancer Australia about advocating for yourself. And I think that's a really important aspect is that if they haven't offered that up, that you are well within your rights to ask for that. There's other areas as well. You mentioned the endometrial cancer with Lynch syndrome, and I want to delve into Lynch a little bit more. But there are other areas too, aren't there, with genetic conditions around bowel cancer like FAP and MAP, is that?
Oh, yeah, MUT1H, yes, and also FAP, which is familial adenomatous polyposis. Yeah, look, there are a number of different genetic bowel conditions, and there are different, I guess, flags for those. So, for example, if someone has a colonoscopy and they're found to have hundreds of polyps, so polyps are little outgrowths in the bowel that can maybe eventually turn into a cancer, they're a risk for cancer. But if someone's making a lot of those, that makes us think of familial adenomatous polyposis or FAP.
I'm glad you said that and I didn't have to say that.
It's a bit of a tongue twister.
I'm just going to call it FAP.
Yeah, that's right. FAP is way easier. Or FAP, that's right. And look, there are different forms of FAP as well. So there is ones that impact people at a young age and there's one we call attenuated FAP, which impacts people in their 50s and 60s. So this is why a genetics referral is helpful because we take all of these little things into consideration. So when someone's diagnosed, how many polyps they've had, what type of polyps they've had. So for example, there's a condition called sessile serrated polyposis or SSP, which we don't have a good known gene that causes that, but we know that it runs in families. So when we see a person who comes to us with lots of sessile serrated polyps, we think, well, do we need to put a plan into place for the family members who are close to them so that they're being screened for these polyps to reduce their chance of bowel cancer?
I want to come back to that family piece because that's a very important part of genetic testing. Mm-hmm. But before we do, Can you talk a little bit more around Lynch syndrome for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So Lynch syndrome is a genetic condition that means that a person is predisposed to develop cancer. And I guess I'm putting emphasis on the word predisposed because some people assume that if you've got a cancer genetic condition, it means you're definitely going to develop cancer. And that's not the case. It just means that you're at a higher risk compared to the average person on the street. So to have Lynch syndrome, there needs to be a gene fault or what some people call a mutation or what scientists call a pathogenic variant in one of the four mismatch repair genes. So there's four genes called MLH1, MSH2, MSH6, and PMS2. They don't stand for anything. They're just what they've been called. But if you have a gene fault in one of those genes, it means that you're predisposed to a subset of cancers. So we all have two copies of these genes. We get one copy from mum and one copy from dad. And if one of those isn't working, that's enough to have that predisposition. The two main cancers that we see in Lynch syndrome, or that we talk about the most, are colorectal cancer or bowel cancer and endometrial cancer. The risk associated with these really depends on what gene is impacted. And each gene has its own profile associated. So I guess some have higher risks than others. And it also depends if you're a man or a woman.
Of course it does. Well, obviously with endometrial.
Exactly. So if you're a man, you can't get endometrial cancer, but you do tend to have a higher risk of bowel cancer if you're a man compared to a woman with Lynch syndrome. There's also sort of a longer list of cancers that are associated with Lynch syndrome as well, but they all have their own risks associated depending on the gene. And I guess the ones that get talked about the most really in, if you go see a genetic counsellor, there's some risk of ovarian cancer for some people, there's some risk of stomach cancers. We sometimes see some cancer, pancreatic cancers, small bowel cancers, and cancers of the ureters, okay, of the bladder. And also some people with Lynch syndrome are predisposed to get little skin lesions that can also be problematic as well. But the risks associated with those are not as high as those associated with the bowel and endometrial cancers.
Gosh, it's just from one little gene, you get so much information, don't you? It blows my mind, I have to say. It just blows my mind.
And this is where we come in because there's a lot of information to give and a lot to remember and a lot to manage because then we have to manage all of that. So what do we do with that risk after that? And that's where a genetic counsellor comes in.
So I suppose take us through that then. That's a great segue. Take us through through that process.
So it looks a little bit different depending on whether you've had a cancer or not. So if you come to us and you've already had a bowel cancer, then your bowel cancer at risk is already going to be managed because you're being managed by a clinical team already. But if you're a woman with a bowel cancer who's diagnosed with Lynch syndrome, then we need to think about your endometrial cancer risk and your ovarian cancer risk if that's applicable to the gene that you have. The recommendations for people with Lynch syndrome is that they have colonoscopies from a young age and usually every year. Again, it depends on the gene. Some of them we're starting to realise the risks aren't as high, and so maybe that colonoscopy can be pushed out to every 2 years. Some Lynch syndrome people will also need to have an endoscopy as well to check their stomach. And for women with Lynch syndrome, the recommendation is actually to have a hysterectomy and a bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy or BSO, so removal of the ovaries and the uterus. Because at the moment, we don't have good screening methods that detect cancers early enough to make a difference. So rather than take the risk, it's easier at an appropriate age, so usually past fertility, to remove that tissue.
But obviously, if you are younger and there is substantial worry or risk, that has a massive impact around your fertility.
Absolutely. And that's where I guess the skills of a genetic counsellor really come forward because it becomes a discussion and a conversation about timing and about what other things are important in life. And we have access to information where we can really sit down and talk about when risks increase. To be able to say, well, look, actually, your risk doesn't increase until this age, to try and provide some reassurance, I guess. And also we involve other medical teams. So we involve the teams from the oncology and surgical field to discuss exactly those options as well about timing so that people are the most comfortable balancing their mental health with their health risks. Because there's also the impact of, for example, removing your ovaries before menopause. So, you know, we're lucky in Victoria, there are some great medical menopause clinics that we can refer patients to have discussions about what could this look like and how can we manage it, because there is more than just hormone treatment, because that can be quite confronting thinking about that as well as your cancer risks. So it's this real balance of making sure that your cancer risk is low, but keeping your quality of life high.
You're essentially empowering the patient with information. You know, you're not making that decision for them.
Absolutely.
You're giving them all the options on the table so they feel empowered, which is something we say constantly. Gain the knowledge and feel empowered.
And it looks different for everyone. One woman will come in and just want to have everything removed, and the next woman will not want anything removed and will just want to take the risk and manage it her in her own way. And it's not our place to judge or decide that for them. And that's what makes our job interesting, I think.
Absolutely. Every situation is unique. So talk us through the impact on loved ones and family members and how they come into the equation with genetic testing and a genetic counsellor.
Absolutely. So when we're talking to a patient, we are never just talking about the patient sitting in front of us. In genetics, we're always thinking about who else is with us, even if they're not in the room. So the person sitting in front of us will have siblings or children or parents or cousins. And because they're all genetically related, we need to be considering what this genetic information means for them. And this can be quite challenging for families to get their head around, because most of the time they've come to us because a loved one is unwell. So again, it's finding that balance between making sure that the person who is sick and unwell and dealing with their cancer is being managed appropriately, but also finding space to discuss how this is going to impact the people around them. And sometimes that most people are fine to just sort of jump in and refer their relatives, but there are other families that we need to provide that space and time for adjustment and for sharing the information between relatives. And we do that in different ways. Every service has their own way of providing information to relatives. But one of the ways we do it is we either offer family members to come to appointments. We offer them, obviously, our contact details to contact us to discuss. We provide what's called a family letter, which has some, I guess, short information to get them enough over the line to understand what's going on, but also contact details to call us should they have any questions. And yeah, it can be quite confronting for people to start thinking about what this means for people who haven't had cancer before and what this could mean for them.
Because I would imagine you have the, you know, there's people that go, okay, I want to be ahead of the game here and I want to know what I possibly could have so I can do my utmost to prevent it. And you'll have others that go, no, I want to stick my head in the sand. What I don't know, I don't know. I'd prefer that. And that might be the loved one, but the actual patient might also be going, no, you need to be across this. So I imagine it could create some real tension within families.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the skills that we have is really around family communication and family dynamics and thinking about the best way to manage that for that particular family. So trying to ask patients to share information with their family is one thing, but allowing people to take control of their own healthcare sometimes is another. And you look, I think it depends on who it is and who's in the family and what their relationship's like beforehand. It can become really complex. But I would say most families, the majority of families, are really well-informed, really want to do the best for their relatives. Information is passed on quite easily, and then we're able to start to branch out further and further as we get more information about other relatives. But when there is difficulty or tension or upset or relationship breakdowns, we try and find ways around that by supporting whoever we're seeing in the room at the time.
Another area that might concern family members is the insurance question. Is this going to impact me and my family ongoing? Do you have any thoughts around that that might help them?
Yeah, the insurance aspect is a complicated one. So up until last year, we had a moratorium on particular insurance products that meant that they weren't able to ask questions about genetic information under a particular policy amount. That's currently being worked on by a team at Monash University, along with Parliament, to try and make some of those points from the moratorium permanent. But yes, genetic testing can impact some people's insurance. Now, the type of insurance we're talking about includes life insurance and income protection. It does not impact insurance like healthcare insurance. So like your Bupa, your Medibank, they cannot ask questions about genetic information. Okay. Basically, an insurance company can discriminate against a person who has a genetic condition and either charge them more premium or not cover them at all. I think it's important that people consider their insurance implications before they come to genetics. It only becomes important when someone has signed a consent form and had their bloods taken for a genetic test. I think the other thing to clarify for insurance is if you've already had a bowel cancer, then you're already impacted. So insurance is in some ways a moot point because you would have to disclose you've had bowel cancer. And so if we find a genetic reason for that, it's not going to change their insurance premiums because of it. Like 2/3 of Australians don't have insurance. And so for most people, it's not important. But for the ones that it is, it's a real barrier.
It's a complex issue. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Talk us through that stressful component, because having cancer's a waiting game across the board. Mm. And then if you have then been sent for genetic testing and you're waiting, what's your advice to patients who are waiting for results? How do you manage that balance?
That's a really great question, Steph. It's really different for everybody. And the waiting game can be quite long. So genetic testing is not like a blood test that, you know, checks your iron and things like that where you can get the next day. Genetic testing can take months. And so most genetic tests take sort of 4 months at the moment, 4 to 6 months. I think most patients find that with time, it can sit in the background a little bit. It feels more intense at the time of your appointment and leading up to an appointment. What we would recommend to patients who are waiting for a genetic test is to make sure that they have support around them should they find that the wait is really stressful, and to have people around them who understand what is happening for them and what they are waiting for and what the implications may be, so that they don't have to explain it often, but they can just say, actually, I'm feeling really uncomfortable about this right now, that people be kind to themselves. And if need be, that they access support, professional support, if they need that. So that may be a counsellor, that may be a psychologist, that might be a psychiatrist. There's access to the mental health care plan. This would be a great reason to access a mental health care plan to put into place to ensure that you're keeping your mental health in check. Because this is really stressful, going through a cancer diagnosis, seeing a family member go through a cancer diagnosis, and waiting to find out if you're at risk as well.
And that mental health care plan, I think some people don't know that they can access that. So that's really great advice. Can I ask, if you want to access, you haven't had cancer, but you want to access genetic screening, how do you go about that? And can you do that?
So if you've not had cancer, but you have a family history, then my recommendation would be that you either, one, contact your local genetic service or get a referral to your local genetic service to talk about your options.
Through the GP?
Through the GP or a specialist. Either is fine. So access to genetic testing as a person who is unaffected, where there is no gene known of in the family, can be difficult to access at times. Now, how genetic testing works in Australia is that it's funded through the hospital system, so through state and federal government money. And how that is allocated is we have to look at who the best person to test is in a family. And usually that's someone who's had a cancer first. And the reason for that is because we have 20,000 genes that tell our body what to do. We still only know about 1/3 of those. So our knowledge has got a really long way to go before we fully understand what all of our genes do, let alone how they all interact. So testing someone who's had a cancer is important because it helps us interpret the result when we get it back. So if we see someone with cancer and it comes back negative, well, that tells us, well, it's not in one of the genes that we know of right now. And so testing someone else in the family is not useful because we don't know what we're looking for. Whereas if we just start with someone who's not had cancer, then we don't know if they've just been lucky not to inherit the thing that's in the family or if it's in one of these genes we don't know about yet. Okay. And that can be really difficult for patients to understand because genetics is portrayed as if we know all the information. And we're not there yet. We've still got a long way to go. There are options to access privately funded genetic testing, so where the patient pays for it. So if you haven't had cancer before and you're wanting that reassurance, there are private clinics that offer that service. And how much it costs really depends on where that testing is being ordered. So different companies offer different prices. And if someone was going to pay for it themselves, then most of the time the genetics team will try and find them the cheapest, the best, most cheapest option. But in saying that, coming to see a genetic service, even if you don't have a genetic test, you would still walk away with advice about how to manage your cancer risk based on your family history.
That's quite important because when you see celebrities and, you know, news love to run stories about Kylie Minogue with her breast cancer, which is great. It raises awareness. Mm. It's fabulous. But I don't think that other part is described. And then everyone wants to have a genetic test to minimise their risk, don't they?
That's right. And I think the thing that's really important to remember is because we don't know everything, we actually can't provide all of that information. And so actually the most important tool that we use is the family history. The family history is what gives us the information to provide the most accurate assessment to an individual who has not had cancer before. And that's why most clinics, if you get referred to, will ask you to complete information about your family. So they'll ask questions like, who's in your family, who has had cancer, who hasn't had cancer, what age they were diagnosed, what type they had. They may ask about treatment because that gives us some ideas about maybe what type of cancer they had if the person doesn't know what it was. We look at how many generations have been affected by cancer and how many people in that family are affected. And we've got some really great algorithms, particularly in the breast cancer space, which I know this is more about bowel cancer, but in the breast cancer space, we have an algorithm tool that allows us to calculate the risk for someone who is at risk of developing breast cancer because of their family history. And that's particularly important when we can't find the genetic cause for it.
Yes, absolutely. Finally, Alicia, I like to ask my guests to recap and give us three quick points they want listeners to take away from today's podcast. What would your top three be?
My top three would be that understanding your family history is really important, that Lynch syndrome is a treatable and manageable condition, and that genetic services are here and you can call and access us at any time.
Honestly, Alicia, it's been such a delight to chat to you today. I feel like we've only touched the surface, as we've said. It's such a dynamic world and it's such a growing field, but also such an exciting space as well. And I think you've really given us a great insight for those that want to understand the genetic path a little bit better. I truly appreciate everything you've elaborated on today and for your time. And thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to the Bottom Line podcast. To find out more about bowel cancer or for support or simply to donate, please go to bowelcanceraustralia.org.